new classes. And for any of those in here that are college students, I've been told to announce that we do have a college class that's already started. It's meeting in the larger classroom back here and to the right. So if you're in here and you want to be in that college class, go ahead and get up and go. You're not going to hurt my feelings or anything if you get up. But that is there for any that are interested in that. Josh is teaching that. We're going to be finishing up the book of Genesis this morning. I appreciate Mike covering last week when I was out of town, covering those chapters. And we're going to begin this morning in around chapter 47. Just touch on something in chapter 47 and then try and finish up the book. I want to just once again bring up that the book of Genesis, especially chapters 12 through 50, really is just about God's covenant he made based on those promises that he made. He spoke about those starting in chapter 12 and repeats them, mentions them again, and expounds on them constantly. And so throughout the book of Genesis, then, we see how God is bringing these promises about and what he's doing and the people involved in these promises and what they're doing as they undergo different situations where God is leading them and bringing about these things he told them that he would bring about. So let's look at chapter 47 and then just verses 7 through 12. Remember, everything we read, think about how it relates to these promises that God has made. That I will be with you and I will bless you and you'll be a blessing. And in you all the nations will be blessed. And he who honors you I will honor and he who dishonors you I will curse. All those things that God promised to Abraham and his offspring come into play throughout the book as we read it. So keep thinking about that as we go through everything. Especially things like this. So this is kind of about where Mike left off last week. Jacob and his whole family have now come to Egypt. Since Joseph is basically the most powerful man in the world, especially in Egypt, even the Pharaoh, who technically is over him, really has just deferred all authority to Joseph. Jacob's whole family has come there, and Jacob himself, the patriarch of this family, he stands before the Pharaoh of Egypt, which is an astounding thing, because from an earthly perspective, Jacob doesn't have much status to be standing in the presence of Pharaoh. And you'll notice, it says, then Joseph brought in Jacob, his father, and stood him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Later, it says, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. Then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land. And Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with food according to the number of their dependents. So just thinking about that, God had told Abraham and his offspring, I will bless you. You then see that, okay, well, one of Abraham's offspring, Jacob, now stands before Pharaoh and blesses the Pharaoh. And Jacob's son Joseph is the most preeminent man in the land and gives his family, the children of Abraham, the best of the land and provides them with all this food during a famine. They are provided with all of this food. So God is taking care of his people, and constantly we see them honored. Especially at times when you think it wouldn't be honored, but God brings it about. And so you see God expounding on these promises. Well, all of this now is starting to conclude everything that Genesis has talked about. So we get to chapter 48, and maybe we don't always recognize this because the word birthright isn't actually stated here in this chapter. But in this chapter, Jacob is going to give the birthright to Joseph. From what we know about the birthright. It means he gets a double portion of the inheritance, and he gets this status of leadership, this preeminent status. That really is what the birthright is all about. And so of all the sons of Jacob, Jacob is going to pass this on to Joseph. And even though the word birthright isn't used here, I mean, 1 Chronicles 5 will talk about this and talk about how, yeah, Joseph got the birthright. It wasn't the other brothers, it was Joseph. But we see here how Joseph is going to get this birthright. And what happens is, Jacob is going to give Joseph the birthright by blessing both the sons of Joseph. And not just blessing them, Jacob is actually going to adopt Joseph's two sons as his own. And so Jacob is going to say, Joseph, your two sons will be considered my sons. Well, think about it. So two of his grandchildren will now become, you know, two of his children, have that status of being his two children. Well, that means that Joseph's two sons now are being treated like sons of Jacob, which means all of Jacob's prosperity, when it's divided up, two portions will go to Joseph, because Joseph's first son will get a portion and Joseph's second son will get a portion. Whereas all the other sons of Jacob just get the one portion, but Joseph gets two because his son Manasseh gets one, his son Ephraim gets one. And so in that way, Joseph gets this double portion of the inheritance because both of his sons get this portion. And so we'll see that in this chapter. So starting in verse 5, Jacob here is talking. He says, and now your two sons who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine, as Reuben and Simeon are. When Israel saw Joseph's sons, he said, who are these? Joseph said to his father, they are my sons, whom God has given me here. And he said, bring them to me, please, that I may bless them. Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age, so that he could not see. So Joseph brought them near him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your offspring also. And he blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the boys. And in them let my name be carried on, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac. And let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. So you'll notice he's talking about Manasseh and Ephraim. But like it says, I mean, he's blessing Joseph by doing this. He's blessing Joseph by giving each of his sons this portion. And now Joseph's two sons will be considered like one of the sons of Jacob. And so that's why, as we go throughout biblical history and look through it, that's why when you think of the 12 tribes of Israel, you don't have a Joseph tribe necessarily. You've got two Joseph tribes. You've got a Manasseh tribe and you've got an Ephraim tribe. And so, well, Joseph gets two, you know, of those. The other brothers don't. The other brothers get one. That's because of what Jacob did here. He took his grandsons and made them on the status of being sons. And so they get this double portion, and that's related to the birthright. They get, Joseph now has this double portion from his father. And so in that way, Jacob is honoring and blessing his son, Joseph. All of that is important because all of it, it's not just that, well, you know, if, you know, father passes on stuff to his son. I mean, there, Jacob is anticipating that all the blessing I'm talking about, all the things I'm referring to, are going to come about in the future because God's going to bring it about. Because God promised all this. God talked about all this. God said he'd give us this land. God said he'd bless us. So when Jacob is saying all this, it's because of his faith that all that's gonna come about because the Lord said it would, and the Lord made those promises. If the Lord wasn't trustworthy, or if the Lord never made those promises, there'd be no point in Jacob even doing any of this. You know, because it doesn't really look like, at this point, they're going to get the land of Canaan, or they're going to be, you know, this amazing, huge nation. I mean, there's only about 70 of them at this point. So any thoughts on that? Any comments or anything involving that? All right, continuing. Now we get to this interesting part here. It says, when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, and he took his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, not this way, my father, since this one is the firstborn, put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. Nevertheless, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you, talking to the two sons, by you Israel will pronounce blessings, saying, God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you again to the land of your fathers. And so once again, we have here Jacob talking about events that are going to be coming in the future. And what he does is, instead of putting his right hand, which is a more prominent hand as far as status goes, instead of putting his right hand on the firstborn of Joseph's sons, he puts his right hand on the secondborn. And he blesses both of them, but the preeminent hand, the preeminent blessing, does go to the younger. Which is interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, because that does actually then come into play as you go through biblical history, that the tribe of Ephraim will be the dominant one compared to Manasseh. And it will be a tribe that has a lot of status. And in thinking about the birthright, how the birthright had to do with preeminence and leadership, well, Ephraim's got that. I mean, Ephraim is a very dominant tribe, does have some of the best land in Canaan, and also once the kingdom divides, I mean, Ephraim kind of becomes synonymous with the whole nation of Israel. I mean, a lot of times when they talk about Israel, they just call it Ephraim, because Ephraim is so dominant and is so preeminent compared to the rest. And kings do come from Ephraim in the northern kingdom. And so you do see that, especially compared to then with Manasseh, where, okay, well, Manasseh is blessed. I mean, it's good, but yeah, not as good as the younger son, Ephraim, as far as the tribes go. Now there's more Jacob's going to say about his sons, especially about Judah, but that's what's happening here. But once again, it is Jacob putting the younger one first, putting the younger one as preeminent, which when you think about Jacob as a young man, when he was young, he also wanted to put the younger one first. He also wanted the younger one to be preeminent because he was the younger one. Remember, Jacob was the younger of his brother. Jacob, you know, wanted to lift himself up, and he got his brother to sell him the birthright, and then Jacob deceived his father and stole the blessing. And so when Jacob was younger, he wanted to have the younger brother himself be the preeminent one. But of course, his motives there were selfish. I mean, completely selfish. Greed and, you know, deception is how he did that. Well, here now, he's doing something similar. The younger one will be the preeminent one. But of course, now it's not from selfish motives. It's not out of deception. It's not something that's self-serving. It's something he's doing as a prophet of God, speaking about the future. And so now he is aligning himself with God's ways on purpose, whereas earlier it was on accident. He was just doing it because he wanted to. But now, as an older man, he is aligning himself with God's ways on purpose, showing that, yes, I am doing things the way God does them because of my faith in God. Whereas earlier in his life, it was because of my desire for me to be so great. And so we'll see that Jacob does this, and it's just similar to really how God has acted anyway throughout the book of Genesis. That so often it is the younger one that God lifts up and honors over the oldest. You see that with Isaac and Ishmael, you see that with Jacob and Esau, and now Jacob is saying also that will be true of Manasseh and Ephraim. And all of this, like I said, is related to these promises that God has made that will come to pass as the years go by. And we'll see them unfold as you read through the rest of the Old Testament. Any comments or questions or anything on the event? Okay. Well, now let's look at chapter 49. We're not going to go into detail here at all, just for the sake of time. We don't have time to do that. But now Jacob is going to bless all of his sons. He's going to pronounce this blessing on all of his sons. And he's going to give some specifics here he hasn't mentioned yet, now that all of his sons are in his presence. But look at how he starts this. You know, I mentioned that he's acting as a prophet, and I think sometimes there's a question like, well, but is he really? I mean, because he, you know, the word prophet isn't necessarily used of him. So, you know, one, is this just a man speaking about what he wants to happen? You know, or is this something that really, no, is from God? And also, is he aware that he's doing this? You know, that question's come up. Like, how aware is Jacob that what he's saying really is prophetic? Is it just something he's saying and, you know, God then hears it and thinks, okay, well, I'm going to then do what Jacob said. I don't think that's the case at all. I think he definitely knows I am acting in some sort of prophetic role. This is from God. Because look at what he says to his sons. Then Jacob called his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come. So he tells them, I'm going to let you know about your future. And not just the individual men's future, not just the individual 12 sons, but he's speaking about the tribes that come from these 12 sons. So he's telling them, I'm going to tell you about future events that God is going to bring about. So he is aware of what he's doing. Now, how he knows this, or did God speak to him and let him know, hey, I'm giving you this ability to do this, I don't know. It doesn't say. But he is aware that he is speaking about future events. And one of the things that he says, and like I said, we don't have time to go into detail about all of what he says to all of his sons, but one of the things he says is, the preeminence and the honor will not go to my firstborn, Reuben. And he says, because Reuben slept with my concubine years ago, so he's not going to be the one that I give preeminence to. So his firstborn is out. And you'll see throughout biblical history, yeah, the tribe of Reuben is not prominent. It's not some just mighty, powerful, magnificent tribe. I mean, it's a tribe, and it's blessed, like all the tribes are blessed, but not at all in some preeminent way. He also says, I'm not going to give preeminence and honor to the next two sons, Simeon and Levi. They're not going to receive prominence and be this magnificent, powerful tribe because of the violent ways that they acted years before. And we talked about that several weeks ago, that the individual men, Simeon and Levi, used deception and murder to take vengeance on their enemies, and in doing so, reflected poorly on their father, reflected poorly on God and his covenant, brought harm or at least brought the possibility of harm to their people. And so because of that, Jacob says, Simeon and Levi are violent. They're not going to be ones that are preeminent either. And what he says is, and I wish we had more time to talk about this, what he says is, they're going to be scattered amongst their brothers. Simeon and Levi will. Well, as you go throughout biblical history, that happens. The tribe of Simeon and the tribe of Levi are scattered amongst their brothers. And the way that happens is Simeon, the tribe of Simeon, really just kind of dissolves into the tribe of Judah. You know, there's so much room in Judah. Simeon kind of fills in places in there. Simeon, the tribe of Simeon never becomes super prominent at all, and even just kind of blends in with Judah to where sometimes they're indistinguishable. And so in that way, the tribe of Simeon is kind of scattered amongst his brother Judah tribe. And the tribe of Levi, what's interesting is, I mean, they're facing the same fate, except when you get to the story of the Israelites, when they make the golden calf, once they've come out of Egypt, made the golden calf, Moses comes down, smashes the Ten Commandments, it's the tribe of Levi that stands up and sides with Moses. And God gives the command, everybody who is not stopping this idol worship and this horrible behavior, everybody that is just blatantly refusing to follow Moses, needs to die. And it's the Levites who side with Moses and say, okay. And they're given the command, take out your swords and slaughter the rebels amongst the Israelites. And the Levites do. They pull out their swords and slaughter their brethren who are rebelling against the Lord. And when that happens, that shows some pretty amazing loyalty on behalf of the Levites. And years later, even one of the Levites, Phinehas, will show the same kind of loyalty where there is fornication and paying honor to other nations and their gods. And Phinehas slays an Israelite man and the Canaanite woman that he took into the camp to sleep with her. He slays them out of zeal for the Lord. And so those two events then relate to what happens with Levi. Because remember, Jacob said Levi will be scattered amongst his brothers. Well, God kind of adapts that, and the way they're going to be scattered is actually a way that also honors them. Because now the Levites, they're not going to have their own land. They're not going to have their own section in the promised land. They are going to become what we know of the Levites, where they have this special role they play in worship, in dealing with the sanctuary and guarding the sanctuary, and setting up all the elements of the sanctuary and that role, and the priests will come from them. The priests who deal with going into the sanctuary and making the sacrifices and determining who's clean and unclean, all of that God talks about as a special honor. They've been set apart for service to the Lord. And so because of that, there need to be Levites in all the tribes to help the tribes with all of that. And so the Levites are scattered amongst their brethren, but it's something that really God turns into a special service that they are rendering for the Lord because of, you know, the zeal they showed in defending the Lord against even their own people at the golden calf incident. So with that in mind, that's a lot. We could talk about that for a lot. But all of that shows that, okay, Jacob's words are coming true. But because Jacob is not going to honor Reuben or Simeon or Levi in this prominent position, the next son up is Judah, which we've seen Judah and his actions throughout Genesis. He's a very, very prominent character in the book of Genesis. And Judah now, probably based on what he's done in the past, where he has stood up for Benjamin and offered to give himself as a slave in order to save Benjamin, demonstrating leadership among his brothers, Judah then becomes the one that Jacob says the scepter, the ruler's staff will be Judah's and will not depart from Judah. And Judah will have this authority and dominion. And of course, then we see as the years go by, that doesn't really happen until you then see that, wow, the first righteous king, David, comes from Judah. And when that happens, Judah is established as the tribe that rules, the tribe that reigns, because God's kings come from Judah. David and his descendants come from Judah, and then ultimately leading up to Jesus, who descends from the tribe of Judah, and so who has the scepter staff and the rule and everything. So all of that is established here in Genesis. And as you go throughout the rest of the Bible, you just see all of this coming to pass, being demonstrated, God's plans unfolding, and all of that is amazing to read and to experience as we look through these stories. Anything on any of that? I know that's like maybe four or five classes worth of stuff that I just went over, but any comments or anything on that topic? Okay, well, Jacob has a final request at the end of chapter 49. He says, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field at Machpelah, to the east of Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. So Jacob's request to Joseph and to all of his sons is, don't leave me here. Don't bury me here in Egypt. Take my body when I die. Take it to that small plot of land that Abraham bought, and that Abraham and Sarah are buried, and where Isaac and Rebekah are buried, and where I buried Leah. Take me there. Now, we may not see the significance of that if we think that, well, he just, you know, there's a family burial plot. Like a lot of us may have, well, there's certain cemeteries where our parents or grandparents or grandparents are buried, so that's the family plot. You'll be buried there. It's just being kind of, you know, symbolically with your family. But that's not really what Jacob's emphasis is on. It's not just that my body would be buried next to my ancestors. It's that it needs to be buried next to my ancestors in that small plot of land that belongs to my ancestors, that's in Canaan, the promised land. Because God said, I'll give you the land of Canaan. And so where are Jacob's family and ancestors buried? In the land of Canaan, in the only little section that they own. Even though they're promised the whole thing, the only little section they really own is this little field with a cave there. You know, a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of what God has promised, but they've got that so far in this story. And so Jacob says, take me there, back to the land that God promised we'd have. That's where I want to be. And so, of course, the significance of that is based on God's promises of the land and of blessing, and not just wanting to be in the family plot. You know, it's way more than that, more significant than that. So we get to chapter 50, and Jacob is taken to Canaan after his death, taken to that place. And just real quickly, I just want us to notice how much honor is given to Jacob. So much honor. Honor that would never be shown to a foreigner in the land of Egypt, ever. And yet Jacob is shown this. Jacob is honored and blessed in this way, really because of God, not because of the Egyptians or because of Joseph or because of anyone else. It's because of God. Because then Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floors of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, this is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Therefore, the place was named Abel Mizraim, which means mourning. It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them, for his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with his field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. After he buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. So let's just appreciate Jacob, upon dying, is being treated like a king, basically. I mean, all of Pharaoh's, you know, people go. I mean, definitely all of Jacob's family goes, but the Egyptians, so much respect, so much mourning is shown for this head of Abraham's offspring, the chosen people. Even the Canaanites see that and think, wow, the lamentation we see, this ceremonial, burial, it's going, all of this is so extravagant. The Egyptians are going all out to honor this man. A man that is not an Egyptian, a man that is not from earthly perspectives, someone prominent, and yet he is one of God's people, God's chosen people. And so he is given so much honor. And we don't have time to get into this, but really is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen to the Israelites. That just as Jacob is honored and leaves Egypt to go to Canaan, well, that's what happens to Israel. They leave Egypt, are given tons of stuff by the Egyptians, leave Egypt to go to Canaan and to be there. And so it's all a foreshadowing of that. Let me just move on to this now. What's interesting now is, now that Jacob's dead, there seems to be, you know, a threat now to all the blessings, because Joseph's brothers all think, all right, now Joseph's going to take vengeance on us for what we did to him years ago. Now that our fathers died, Joseph is going to have no one holding him back, and he's going to kill us or enslave us or something like that, which, of course, is so upsetting to Joseph. Joseph cries, just weeps that they would think that. And what's so amazing here is what Joseph says. But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." And so Joseph's perspective of this is, yeah, I know that you meant to sin against me, but our God, who is powerful enough to do this, took your actions and used those sinful actions to bring about good so that we could all survive and live. And that really is what the Bible is about. That despite the sinful actions of man, God took sinful actions and used those to bring about good so that all could live. And so even the death of Jesus, which was mankind trying to bring about evil, God used that to bring about salvation for all. And so this is a huge foreshadowing of that, and really a theme you see throughout the Bible, that God can't just work through righteous actions. God even can work through the sinful actions of individuals to bring about good. Not that it excuses the sins of the individuals, but it is a method God can use to bring about good, and here he brings it about for salvation, and Joseph sees that and realizes that. And once again, it's all related to the fact that God does that because God made these promises. He promised the offspring of Abraham this, and he's keeping those promises. By even the sinful actions, they're not going to stop his promises from coming to pass. Anything before we move on from that? All right. Alright, so one final passage here in Genesis. Joseph dies, and look at what Joseph says. Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here." So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. So Joseph says a couple things here. One, okay, I'm dying, but God's going to bring you out. You're not destined to be here in Egypt. God is going to visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land he promised to give to Abraham. But Joseph also says, and you're going to carry my bones from here and take them to that land, because that's where I'm destined to be. I'm not even going to stay permanently, even in death, I'm not going to stay in Egypt. I'm going to Canaan. Well, think about the original audience of Genesis. Moses is writing this for the Israelites. They've already experienced this. God did visit them and bring them up out of the land to the land that he swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They've left Egypt. He visited them, they left, and they're going to Canaan. So they're seeing, wow, what God and Joseph, you know, through the knowledge of God, said is coming to pass. And Moses even has in his possession the bones of Joseph. In Exodus, we read, Moses took the bones of Joseph and took those with him when they left Egypt. So even when the Israelites are hearing this book of Genesis, they know, wow, we actually have Joseph's bones among us. It really is happening. Joseph really is being taken out of Egypt and taken to the promised land. And so you see that coming to pass. And I want to end with this. All that we've looked at through 12 through 50, chapters 12 through 50, you see that from the perspective of the original audience, these Israelites who are listening to this, what Moses has written, what Moses has given to them, the book of Genesis, they're seeing who God is. And they're seeing that God has made these promises. And they're also seeing not just these promises, but also all these threats, all these barriers that come against these promises. All these things that seem like they're going to hinder these. That, oh no, the children of Abraham won't be blessed. They will be dishonored. They won't be avenged for the people that cursed them. They won't get this land. There won't be this blessing that comes from them. They won't develop into a huge nation. There's all of these threats. That this is what the Israelites are seeing as they're hearing the book of Genesis. And so, I just want to look at, when you look through the book of Genesis, there are so many things that seem like they're going to stop God's promises. There are just countless things that seem like God can't keep his promises, because look at this. This seems to completely go against what God said was going to happen. This seems like it's going to actually cause the promises to be ripped apart. I just read through and looked at everything that seems like it dishonors Abraham, dishonors Isaac, dishonors Jacob. Something that causes them not to be able to reproduce. Something that causes them not to be able to get the land of Canaan. Something that causes them to be cursed. Something that puts them in danger. Something that's going to end their lives. All of these things seem like, well, those promises of God cannot come to pass, will not come to pass. And yet what we see in the book of Genesis and what the original Israelites saw was, no, those things don't stop God's promises at all. In fact, God just bursts through those. In fact, most of those seem like a threat, but they're not a threat at all. God's already provided a solution to them before the threat even came up. And so it's just astounding to see how skilled God is at keeping his promises and how trustworthy God is at keeping his promises. And one of the largest threats, probably the biggest threat to these promises is this. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, Leah, Rachel, and Joseph, they all died. Right? They all died without receiving the full promises. Maybe little portions of it. You know, they got that small land in Canaan. You know, Jacob saw he had a decent number of sons and grandsons. Didn't see a nation come from him yet. All of these people experienced just a small percentage. They didn't receive all that's on this blue chart right here. They died. And so the only thing they can think is either we died, either we're dying, we're going to die, and we're not going to eat God's promises, or we're going to return from death because God keeps his promises to us. And that's the mindset that the Hebrew writer says they had. that, yeah, they died, but they died in faith, knowing God keeps those promises. Death itself is not something that's going to stop God's promises from coming true. He's got something prepared for us. He's got a country for us. He's got blessings for us. And we're going to receive those even though we're all in the grave. We're still going to receive those. And what I want to say finally is just this. That according to the book of Galatians and other places, it's not just those people that are the descendants of Abraham. That we, through faith in Jesus, are sons of Abraham. We, through faith in Jesus, are descendants of Abraham. And so we receive God's promises. We are the inheritance of those promises, which means even death itself doesn't stop us from receiving those promises of God. And the book of Genesis teaches us that, that God made promises and keeps promises, and nothing can stop those from coming to pass. So just an amazing, amazing book and amazing lessons for us. And it leads right into Exodus, where God continues to expound on fulfilling his promises. And so we'll stop there. Thank you very much. I appreciate your attention.